about you, but I have found being in Chicago a little sad these days. The crimes, the shooting, the mass shootings are a daily occurrence. The middle of the week, the weekends have a surge. The police are resigning. 363 police have resigned since the beginning of the year. On Wednesday, we had two mass shootings with 27 shot in one day. 4th of July had 101 shootings, 16 dead. So we're going to talk a little bit about what the causes are for this upswing in shootings. What is the solution? And with us is one of my favorite people to discuss this is Dr. Lance Williams, who is a PhD and associate professor at Northeastern University, co-author of the book The Almighty Black Peace Donation, The Rise, Fall, and Resurgence of an American Gang. He works with Chicago Public Schools with elementary and high school students who are at risk, and he has served as an expert in gang violence. And he's been a regular on the show. Dr. Williams, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Karen, and I'd like to just say hi to all of your listeners.
I really appreciate your weighing in on this, because you're a voice of reason, and some of the things you say are not exactly what people think. And let's start with the basics of what do you believe, with your experience and the studying that you've done and even being there on the streets, what is the reason for this level of violence? Is it not? Is it lack of aggressive policing? Is it the George Floyd issues? What is going on with the city that is causing this surge in violence?
Right. Well, I think, you know, one of the first things that we have to keep in mind when we talk about, you know, violence in general, measuring it within our communities, we always have to compare it to other, I guess, jurisdictions, so to speak, of comparable size, comparable circumstances. And Chicago tends to get compared a lot to New York City and Los Angeles. So one of the ways that we could determine how bad things are or how good things are here in the city of Chicago is to kind of see what's going on in places like New York and places like L.A. And then if you look at those cities, you'll see that our rates, our homicide rates, our violent crime rates are much higher than comparable cities, in some cases 3 or 4 times higher. So that's where we start with just getting a sense of what's going on now. To look at the differences without going into too much detail, we do know that there have been some changes here in Chicago over the last 20 years or so pertaining to public housing policy and public education policy that played out a lot differently than those institutions in New York and L.A. And right now, when we look at the uptick of violence that you just mentioned, we have some current things, the coronavirus and how it impacted policing, social justice movement, how it impacted policing. But on top of that, we haven't gotten over two devastating policies here in Chicago, and that's Chicago Housing Authority's Plan for Transformation and Chicago Public Schools Policy of Renaissance 2010, which essentially just ended last month after being implemented in the early 2000s. So those two policies had a devastating impact, particularly on African-American communities that were the most marginalized. They really disrupted housing circumstances, displacement of large populations of individuals that were already struggling, pushing them into communities that were struggling. It altered the landscape of street gangs and kind of fractured them and caused different groups to get mixed in with each other, and that kind of escalated violence. So those two big policies we're still attempting to recover from 20 years later.
Dr. Williams,
keep those things in mind.
Yeah. Dr. Williams, and I hear people say, well, you know, poverty and lack of jobs and those types of things, tell me how they translate into violence, because I think we hear that, and sometimes people say, well, there are plenty of places that are poor in this country, and really poor, that don't have that level of violence. So can you explain as simply as you can how that feeling, the displacement and the lack of jobs and the lack of hope, how that translates into someone taking a gun and murdering somebody?
Yeah, so I think what you see playing out is, and, you know, those two big policies, and excuse me for kind of being long-winded with it, but just trying to set the context. So, you know, those two policies, along with some other things, exacerbate a problem that already exists. And I want to just touch on this a little bit, which I think is really important. And that is that there are already issues, and, you know, we just have to have an open and frank conversation about the issues of this idea of what I would call black male kind of identity crisis stuff going on, which is kind of unique. And so in our community, in African-American community, as kind of a backdrop to the larger society, right? We live in a society that's essentially dominated by men. We the society in general is trying to get over that and get past that, of course. But generally, you know, we have this male dominated kind of society where men rule, they dominate, they are the authority figures, so to speak. But in larger society where essentially white men are in that space, right? When it comes to African American males who are from poor communities, who are guided by those same principles of male dominance and rule and authority. However, they don't have access to the institutions to kind of exercise their manhood. Then what happens is their manhood gets exercised in a very crude way, and the only access that they have to kind of tools of power are their physical presence, right? And so we see easy access to guns, this role strain of being a man or not being a man, or trying to prove that you're a man, and then being in an environment that I just talked about in terms of not having access to quality education, meaning that you don't have a life, you know, opportunities, and you can't get a job, and, you know, you're having struggles finding housing. All of those things kind of go together, and when that male toxicity gets mixed in with all of this other stuff, then we see violence playing out.
And, you know, you have said repeatedly that this violence, it's not necessarily gang-related, although some of it is. And can you explain a little bit before we go to break what you mean by that, and that it's more societal and cultural and may have to do with personal disputes rather than gang-related turf battles?
Yeah, I think if you look at the violence that's played out, historically played out in African-American community, most of it has been interpersonal conflict coming from this identity crisis deal that I just talked about. And, you know, it's interesting because recently a noted professor out of Northwestern did a study and basically came to the same conclusion that African-Americans have been saying for 20 or 30 years, and that is that very little of the violence that's playing out in the streets is actually gang-related. Most of it is, again, interpersonal conflict where two individuals challenge each other's manhood, and because they don't have access to ways to resolve it in a peaceable way or in a mainstream way, it plays out in violence.
Very, very interesting. Let's take a break, and when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about some topics that are of interest to you, which is funding for some of the solutions to the problem of crime in Chicago. We're talking to Dr. Lance Williams, who's a PhD associate professor at Northeastern University. We'll be back in a minute. We're talking about violence in Chicago. We talked a little bit about some causes with Dr. Lance Williams, but I want to talk now about some bullet points, and I don't want to use that word, pardon the pun, I guess. What would be some of the bullet point solutions that you see as a person with who has both the academic background here and the statistics behind you, but also some really good experience on the streets, tutoring and mentoring young people?
Yeah, so I would, you know, if I were to touch on some bullet points, I would say the most important thing is that the resources that are being allocated to address issues like violence, but particularly, you know, community level violence, have to reach the individuals that are in the communities that are most at risk. And that has not happened to this point. So we need to invest directly in human development initiatives. You know, we have to invest in affordable housing. That's like a really big problem in these communities where individuals are not having access to, you know, just basic, decent housing. We have a big challenge with mental health in many of these communities because individuals are struggling with coping with the stress and anxiety of living in these very, you know, harsh kind of conditions, a lot of substance abuse. The whole idea of job training, I think, is somewhat misguided, you know, because of the job market and the individuals who are the ones that are most active in doing the violence are so marginalized and so far away from being able to be qualified to do, you know, just basic, you know, level employment. We need some kind of entrepreneurial training kind of initiatives for them. And you know, I think those are some key things. We have to, you know, reestablish community high schools. That's like a real big problem as well. You know, we've gotten away from that over the years. Family, you gotta have to do some family engagement therapy kind of things because families have really taken a hard hit in these areas over the last 20 years or so. You do need to have money for violence prevention. That's important. But it can't be just that outreach model that we have right now. That doesn't work.
What do you mean by that? Well, outreach as a, tell me what you mean.
Well, you know, I don't know if I'm sure you followed the basic practice and tradition of community level violence prevention really centers around outreach workers. These are generally individuals who were formerly, you know, in the streets, formerly, you know, gang members themselves, probably, you know, many of them are returning citizens who are now old enough to see the errors of their ways. They get jobs working for these violence prevention agencies to actually go out into the communities that are most affected to engage the population that's active in the streets, you know, perpetrating violence. Now, that does not reduce violence. There's no evidence that really works. They are effective at engaging the population, but you need more than just the ability to talk to somebody to stop them from doing violence, right? You need to be able to have resources with you to plug them into. And at currently, that is not a part of the outreach efforts, right? You know, the city is only investing, you know, $16 million to $20 million a year in violence prevention that's being split up among a number of agencies. And while that may seem like a lot of money, you have to understand that the problem of violence in Chicago is at least a $2.5 billion problem. Like it actually costs the city at minimally $2.5 billion a year for homicides and non-fatal shootings. And so to try to fix that with $16 million is just ridiculous, right? Some more money is coming, but at this point, you know, just $16 million outreach is just not enough.
And now you mentioned to me privately that the Biden administration is considering some funding to target violence prevention. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. Yeah, so the Biden administration has, and I don't think that the bill has been approved yet because it's a part of the jobs and infrastructure plan. So it's $5 billion that has been set aside to support community-based violence prevention programs across the United States of America. It's a sizable amount of money. But the problem is, and I'm really concerned, I've had an opportunity to talk to some of the people in the administration, and I'm not sure if they quite get it. If that money that they send to, that they're planning to send to, you know, the cities most affected by, I think there are 40 cities that they're planning to, you know, spread this money out among in states. That money goes to, which it looks like it's going to the state coffers or to like a city like Chicago, going to be a problem because generally what happens is elected officials dole out those resources and money based on political ties and connections, not necessarily people who are on the ground doing the work. So what happens is ultimately, and we've seen this over the years, a lot of that money just gets taken right off the top and never gets down to the people that actually need it, the ones that are actually engaging in the violence. right? And so I warned the Biden administration to it would be better to keep that money within the federal government coffers and have people at the community level apply for the money directly to through federal agencies like, you know, HUD or through, you know, DHS or through the Department of Justice. Because if you send that money to the state of Illinois or the city of Chicago, they're going to give it to people who are their political friendlies who may probably are not the ones that are tied to the community. So a lot of that money is going to be lost.
Interesting. I do want to talk a little bit about policing. I think I've heard you on television say that you're not a person who wants to defund the police. You know, obviously it's a spectrum of defund the police, let not have any police, and you're not in favor of that. Is there something to be said about the fact that the police maybe aren't being aggressive right now because of the number of reasons that we all are aware of? Does that impact crime, or does that really not have much impact at all?
Oh, yeah. I think it has a major impact on crime. And, you know, I talked to the rank and file law enforcement police, you know, almost on a daily basis. And you know, they're extremely frustrated with what is taking place, you know, on a lot of different levels. I think a lot of the frustration that they experience in doing this work, which is a no-win situation because the conditions are so bad, and they feel, you know, disrespected, they feel unappreciated because they're putting their lives on the line, you know, and a lot of this frustration, similarly to what's happening in the neighborhoods, a lot of this, the frustration, it plays out in anger. And sometimes, you know, the law enforcement, even though they're professionals, they lose, you know, a sense of perspective, and they act out just like the streets do, right? And so I think the pandemic has caused police to be a lot more reluctant to engage, just simply to try to stay safe. But you remember that the pandemic hit at the same time as the whole George Floyd situation, a lot of protests, a lot of anger directed at the police. And so, I talked to a lot of police who just said, you know, just screw it. You know, you guys, you don't want us. You want to tie our hands and how we, you know, engage this impossible problem. You know, you want us to risk our lives and, you know, you curse us and you. And so, OK, great. You guys just stand back with, you know, stand down. And just watch all of the madness unfold. And what happens is individuals in the communities who see this as an opportunity to exploit the lack of police presence or that police are not, you know, engaged, they take advantage of it and the violence escalates.
Dr. Williams, I when I see a police officer in my neighborhood, I'm happy to see the police officer, and I know my police officers in my neighborhood, and I talk to them, and we talk about issues. But in some of the marginalized communities on the west side, the south side, if I were in one of those communities, I would think that I would want to see police officers there. I'd want to feel safe. I'd want to know that they're there to try to prevent crime. Does the average person in those communities want the police there?
I think the average person does, but that the average person is not the problem. The problem are those individuals who are engaged in the, you know, the violence. And, you know, and it's interesting. I spend a lot of time almost daily working with that population as well. And when the whole conversation of defund the police comes up and talking to them, and now these are individuals who will tell you straight out that they hate the police. Right. They don't like the police, but they don't like it, you know, like the police for a different reason. They don't like the police because of the brutality sometimes that's associated with policing, and that they feel that they're being, you know, that they're being targeted by law enforcement, that they're being treated in brutal ways. That's the reason. But in terms of police presence in their community, these same individuals who claim not to like the police or hate the police will tell you straight up that it would be the worst thing ever to remove police from their communities, because you have to take into consideration they still are concerned about their families and overall safety in their community, even though they may be involved in, you know, criminal or violent kind of activities. So on one hand, they don't want to be brutalized. They don't want to be, you know, shot down in the streets. But they do recognize the importance and the role that police play in the overall, you know, state of the community. So they're not for the defund police situation either. They will say, yeah, it's probably better to take some of the money that we give to law enforcement and give it to social service agencies that can help, you know, in areas of education, mental health, substance abuse. Yeah, we could redirect some of the funding in that way, but not just do away with the police altogether.
We have literally 30 seconds. Do you think we're going to see a change in this and for the positive in the next year to 2 years?
Unfortunately, I wish I could tell you. I'm not optimistic. I don't think we're going to see much of a change in the next year or so.
Well, I hope you are wrong, but you're probably right. Dr. Lance Williams, thank you so very much for joining me, and thank you for all the good work you're doing in the city. And I hope that some ears will perk up and listen to what you have to say, because I trust that what you're saying really resonates with me.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Take care. Have a good rest of your afternoon, and you stay safe.